Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the United States, they've got this national holiday called Columbus Day to commemorate the Italian explorer Christopher Columbus, who, it was said, discovered America in 1492. Except that America didn't need discovering because people had been living there for thousands of years, and Columbus wasn't the first European to get there anyway. A Viking named Leif Erikson made the voyage from Iceland to North America a full 500 years before that. And Columbus didn't even land on the North American mainland. He set foot on a Caribbean island. And I think that in the end, the Leif Erikson saga is way more fun than the Columbus story, which ends in disease and mass slavery. Matt Bevan is with me today. Matt loves fact-checking these kinds of claims that sort of stick in the mind that aren't really quite true. He admits in his new book that he can be a bit of a buzzkill, but I love this stuff. And so do Matt's legions of listeners and viewers. Matt, as many of you will know, is the presenter and writer of the brilliant podcast and TV show If You're Listening, which he describes as a show where he explains the biggest story in world news while hiding in his basement from assassins and authoritarian regimes. Now Matt has a very entertaining book that's packed with stories behind the stories about things that might have happened the way you think they happened but probably didn't, like what became of that teenager who flew a Cessna into the car park of Red Square? And was Alexander Downer really at the centre of a massive plot to discredit Donald Trump? And why do human beings perceive vertical lines to be longer than horizontal ones? Matt's book is called If You're Listening, Declassified. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Richard.
Are you really making that show in your basement?
Yes, I live in Newcastle, and we bought this house in 2020 there when we realised we couldn't afford to live in Sydney anymore and moved home to where I'm from in Newcastle. And we bought this house that had a downstairs room that didn't really have a purpose. You know, storage rooms, garage, that kind of thing. Can't really use it as a bedroom. The kids would never use it as a playroom. It's a little bit too big to be an office. It's kind of odd. And then someone made the suggestion that we should start turning, If You're Listening, our podcast into a video and TV product as well as being an audio podcast. And we were sort of going, am I going to need to come down to Sydney to film it in a studio? Am I going to need to, you know, monopolise part of the ABC Newcastle office, which, as you know, Richard, is not massive, and they probably wouldn't be super keen on me turning a big section of it into a TV studio.
No, workers are pretty much stacked vertically on top each other in Newcastle.
Yes. That's right. And I went, you know what, I've got this strange-shaped room that doesn't have any purpose in my house. Can we try that? And so we've given over one room of my house, which is not a large house, to be this downstairs strange sort of semi-basement room to be a TV studio, and that's where If You're Listening is made.
A large part of your book is about how unstable history is, and this is very, very true. People who write history know very well that they often sound more confident relating events than they really feel, because everything is really quite unstable. The events are often told through a whole lot of different voices that rarely agree on things. People's memories are very unreliable. There's a lovely story that illustrates this very nicely at the start of your book about a lemon tree that appeared in a palace in the Crimean city of Yalta during the Yalta Conference of 1944. It's a lovely story because it involves these great world leaders like Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. Tell me about this palace where the conference took place.
So, obviously, it was 1944, so the Soviets have retaken the Crimean Peninsula from the Nazis. And it was clear at this stage that the Allies were going to defeat the Nazis, and it was decided that they needed to have a meeting of the major Allied powers to basically decide what are we going to do with Germany? Once we beat them, what are we going to do? And Stalin managed to convince the others that he would be the host of this meeting. And for very Stalin-y reasons, he decided that he would have this meeting not in Moscow, not in St. Petersburg, but in Yalta, this city that had been recaptured just weeks earlier from the Nazis.
This is like a resort town, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, it was a resort town. The Crimean Peninsula is basically the resort area of the Russian Empire and the USSR. It's where all the Tsars would go for summertime retreats. The Sea of Azov is there, and the Sea of Azov is unusually warm. It's a fantastic place to visit. And they had retaken it. And so Stalin wanted to have this meeting in Yalta. But the thing was, Yalta was a ruin. It had been invaded first by the Nazis and then by the Soviets in the opposite direction. And it had basically been destroyed. And the palace, the Livadia Palace, is where Stalin wanted to have this meeting. And it was a total wreck. I mean, the Soviets hadn't been looking after it because it was a, you know, Tsarist sort of decadent, ridiculous Tsarist era relic. It had been used as a mental hospital. It had been used as various other types of hospitals. The Nazis had been living in it, and it was destroyed. It was this horrible place.
Now,
but it's,
now, if I'm one of the representatives of Roosevelt or Churchill who's coming to visit, one of the things, first questions on my mind is going to be, does this palace have working plumbing? Did it have working plumbing?
Nope. No, I mean, there were a couple of toilets that worked. They decided to put Roosevelt in a room that had a working toilet, but we're talking about the absolute high command of the Allied military is there, and they are being put in rooms that don't have toilets and don't have any access to toilets. And so every morning there would be a massive queue outside the one working toilet on the ground floor of the Livadia Palace. Many generals and admirals were forced to relieve themselves outdoors. There was mosquitoes everywhere. There was not proper running water. It was an absolute tip.
But one thing they did have, though, was lots of alcohol, right?
They did, absolutely. And Roosevelt and Churchill both did love a cocktail. And so in a meeting, one of the stories that comes out of this is that Roosevelt had a meeting with Stalin one night. And, well, I'll read you the account that comes from Robert Hopkins, who was a photographer who was with the American delegation. He says, "Since it was about cocktail hour, the president repeated a ritual he regularly performed at the White House. He made a pitcher of dry martinis. He passed a glass to Stalin. He said apologetically that a good martini really should have a twist of lemon. At 6 o'clock the following morning, when I came down to the main entrance hall, I was astonished to find, just outside the door to the anteroom, a huge lemon tree. I counted some 200 pieces of fruit on it, which Stalin had ordered flown in from his native Georgia so the president could serve his martinis with a twist."
Now, I like that story very much.
Me too.
And even though it's kind of odd, it's really quite plausible. We do know for a fact that Roosevelt loved to make pitchers of martinis, yes, in the White House. We do know that when Stalin gave an order, it was often obeyed. And so it's wacky, like there's suddenly a lemon tree out of nowhere with 200 lemons hanging from it. But then what did the British say happened with this lemon tree?
Yeah, well, that's the fascinating thing. So the British were staying in a nearby palace, not the same Livadia Palace. They were in the Vorontsov Palace, which is nearby. And Churchill then, after the whole thing, returned to England and then told a story about what had happened there. And one of the stories was written down from Churchill's report of what he had experienced in Yalta. He gave a vivid picture of Yalta. The Russians had made a tremendous effort to prepare for their reception in two of the old palaces of the nobility of Tsarist times. Everywhere, all around, was destruction. One day, a British officer had asked for a lemon and had been given, with great apologies, an orange. The next day, there appeared two lemon trees, each covered with ripe fruit, which were rapidly erected in a flower bed outside the palace where the soldiers were staying.
All right, now this is a very different story now.
It is.
So, now, we've got two lemon trees here.
Different palaces
as
well.
And a different palace.
Yes.
And it comes out of a request for an orange, not something to stick in a cocktail.
Yes, the British officer had asked for a lemon and had been provided the following morning with a lemon tree outdoors. The first lemon tree was in the hallway, ready for Roosevelt to turn into martinis. But now we've got two lemon trees outside the British palace.
Okay. So what was Churchill's own version of events that he published in his own accounts of the Second World War?
Yes. So Churchill famously wrote massive tomes about the Second World War after the fact. He said, "Every effort was made by..." Should I do it in Churchill's
Please.
Voice again? "Every effort was made by our hosts to ensure our comfort, and every chance remark was noted with kindly attention. On one occasion, Admiral Reginald Portal had admired a large glass tank with plants growing in it and remarked that it contained no fish.
2 days later, a consignment of goldfish arrived. Another time, somebody said casually there was no lemon peel in the cocktails. The next day, a lemon tree loaded with fruit was growing in the hall. All must have come by air from far away.
Okay, this is another third completely different version of how they got lemons for their drinks. And now you've got a fish tank full of fish as well.
Yes, that's right, yes. Things are appearing everywhere, which, you know, potentially is the way it was. The Soviets were known to have been spying on everybody, and if anybody remarked that they wanted something, the Soviets would be very keen to provide it because they couldn't provide working toilets. They could potentially provide fruit.
Okay, so now if you're writing the history of this, the two questions you have to ask yourself is, one, which is the account that's written closest to the event described? The second question is, how plausible is each of these accounts? I know what I think.
Yeah.
What's your call on this, Matt?
Well, I mean, it's really impossible to say. But I mean, I think probably that there was one lemon tree.
Mm.
I mean, I love the Roosevelt story the best because, you know, Roosevelt and Stalin are there having drinks late in the evening and then Stalin makes a tree arrive the following day. So that's a possibility. Were there multiple lemon trees as well? That's also a possibility. Perhaps.
So the British could have had some and the Americans could have had some.
Potentially.
That's, potentially.
Or one lemon tree has been brought in at some point and everybody's heard about this and then they've returned home to Britain and America and they've gone, I've got this amazing story. Stalin made a lemon tree appear right outside my room, you know, and you end up with multiple lemon trees even though there was only one lemon tree at the centre of it.
Can I tell you what I suspect is going on here?
Please tell me.
This has happened to me several times in my life. Where
lemon trees appearing out of nowhere.
No, this has happened to me several times where I've been in the company, someone I've been very close to, for whatever reason, friend or otherwise, and they've told a dinner party an anecdote where they're at the centre of this story about this thing that's happened to them, and I know as I'm hearing it that it's not their story at all, it's mine.
Yes, yes.
And I wait for this person to finish this story, and I say, you must know full well that you were never there, and this is a false memory you have. This is from a story I've told you. And they go, no, there's a lot of indignation. And when they realise that it's a false memory, this is a deep shock. I suspect this is a case of the British getting a story from Roosevelt and the Americans that became their own false memory. But again, who knows? I can't know this. But the American version of the story seems to be the most plausible one. Isn't it nice to be able to say that in this day and age, Matt?
Absolutely. But, you know, we've got all these first-hand accounts, but historians have written about this. And the British, if you read the British Foreign Office's official history, then they say that the tree appeared outside of the British palace and it was requested by Churchill's daughter, Sarah. So we've got now a fourth version of the story, but that is the one that's been accepted by the historians of the British Foreign Office.
It's a nice, clean little anecdote from the American original, but now it's got hair growing all over it.
Yes,
and
I know,
and it's reproducing, and it's this kind of mess now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a puddle of a story, which was once this lovely, beautiful, pristine thing.
Absolutely. But if you or I were writing a history of the Second World War, and we got to this story, we would almost be forced to pick one because, you know, in the middle of a thing about tanks and about, you know, this happened and that happened and these terrible events and the Holocaust and all these terrible things, you can't go, I'm going to stop the story right now and I'm going to spend 3.5 pages writing about the provenance of a lemon tree. A historian would pick one of those stories, write it down, go, it's probably pretty close to the truth and charge on. But, you know, I had the joy of being given a book contract and no real instructions about what I was to put in it. And so I decided to spend 4, 5, 6 pages writing about a lemon tree and nobody could stop me.
Now, the title of your program, I believe, comes from the 2016 US presidential campaign when Donald Trump, on the podium, called on Russia to find and release the notorious emails of Hillary Clinton.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
Now, this comment of Donald Trump's gets us to some strange conspiracy theories centered around an encounter that you've got in your book that took place in a bar one night in London during that election campaign. And this was an encounter between a young Trump advisor named George Papadopoulos and former Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer, our longest-serving foreign minister, served in the Howard government throughout its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
You spoke to both men.
Yes, I did.
I saw this story unfold in the New York Times, and in the end, I just walked away from it because I couldn't make head or tail of it, and thankfully you have in this case. Now, when you spoke to both men, what reason did Alexander Downer give for meeting this Trump advisor, who's not in government yet, in a bar in London?
So, yeah, George Papadopoulos wasn't even a paid advisor. He was sort of a volunteer to the Trump campaign, and he was touring around Europe, just meeting people, you know, meeting people here, meeting people there, talking about what the Trump campaign might do if Donald Trump was elected president and that kind of thing. And in Alexander Downer's telling of the story, someone in the Israeli embassy said, oh, you might want to chat to this guy. He's from the Trump campaign. He's sort of talking about what the Trump campaign's priorities are. And Alexander Downer, through one of the diplomats, because, of course, at the time, Alexander Downer was the Australian High Commissioner.
Like the ambassador, effectively.
Exactly, to the United Kingdom. So he was Australia's man in London, and there was a representative of the Trump campaign there, and he went, well, maybe I'll meet with this guy, see if he's got anything interesting to say.
So this is pretty routine. This is what our diplomats often do, isn't it? And Downer was a diplomat in this case, as a High Commissioner. You meet with people from one of the party campaigns because they might be the next administration, which indeed was the case when it came to Trump's people. So that's his reasoning. What did Downer tell you happened in that bar, in that meeting with George Papadopoulos from the Trump campaign that night?
So Downer's version of this story is that they met up at the Kensington Wine Rooms, which is a wine bar.
Not the Dog and Duck. No. It's not their style. No.
Right. But he did tell me that neither he nor Papadopoulos were impressed with the wine selection. And so they both had G&Ts. They had one or two G&Ts. They had not a particularly interesting conversation to start with. But then, Downer says, George Papadopoulos told him that the Russians had a large trove of dirt on Hillary Clinton. This was during the campaign between Trump and Hillary Clinton, and that they were going to release this information at some point. And this was something worthy of a sort of a note. Downer went, oh, that's interesting. I'll remember that. But didn't think all that much of it at the time. It was only after the campaign emails started to be released online that Downer went,
oh,
hang on. Someone told me that this was going to happen a couple of weeks ago. That guy works in the Trump campaign. That's something that's probably interesting. And reported this back to the Department of Foreign Affairs in Canberra. And the Department of Foreign Affairs in Canberra went, whoa, that's well above our pay grade. We don't know what to do with that. We're going to tell the Americans. And so they called up the FBI and informed the Americans of what Downer had heard.
Because this is still the Obama administration at this point, isn't
it? That's right.
The election hasn't happened yet, and Barack Obama and his people are still running the United States.
Yes, so this is about midway through 2016. There is still 7 months to go of the Obama administration, and the FBI have received this report that someone on the Trump campaign knew ahead of schedule about the Russians having information from inside of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And it was told to us by the Australians.
So what happened when the New York Times got word that Alexander had had a meeting with this Trump advisor and this had been disclosed to him?
Well, the New York Times found out about it a year and a half later. They sort of went, oh, this is an odd thing. The context was, of course, that by the end of 2017, so this is when the New York Times started reporting on it, there was now already a massive government investigation into the Trump campaign's connections or alleged connections with the Russian government during the presidential campaign of 2016.
Right, because you have to ask yourself the question, if what Papadopoulos was saying was true, how did the Trump campaign know that Russia had done this?
Are they working together on something? Is there some sort of a collusion, of course, was the word that went around so much in 2017. Was there some collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government's attempts to undermine the election?
So this looks bad for Trump. What was Papadopoulos' version of that meeting with Alexander Downer?
So Papadopoulos has a very complicated understanding of this meeting. So Papadopoulos says that it was just a totally normal, uninteresting meeting. He met with Downer. He agrees they had G&Ts. He says, I never said anything about Russia in this meeting. And he also said that he thought that Alexander Downer was recording him.
On what?
On his phone. He thought that he sort of recorded him on his phone throughout the meeting. He said he felt very suspicious and odd during the conversation and that it was pretty short and he left. Now, the crucial fact about this is in the story of the investigation into the Trump campaign. So this thing that led to James Comey, the FBI director, being fired and the years-long Robert Mueller investigation that caused so many problems for the first Trump administration. The story the FBI told everyone was that this meeting between Papadopoulos and Downer was the beginning of the investigation. So when the Australians told us that this had happened, that's when we started the investigation. So we started the investigation because of this meeting.
Are there any improper connections between the Trump campaign and the Putin regime?
That's right. And it all started because of this report from Alexander Downer, is what they say.
So was Papadopoulos saying that Downer had set him up?
Yes. Papadopoulos was saying to the New York Times and to anyone who would listen, including me, in our conversation, that he thought that this was all an elaborate setup by the FBI, the CIA, the Australian intelligence agencies, possibly Ukrainian intelligence for some reason. All of these agencies were all working together because they wanted to start an investigation into Trump. They wanted to derail his campaign, derail his presidency by accusing him of having links to Russia, and that they manufactured this whole story out of the Downer meeting.
Now, at this point, Australians hearing this story will go, wait a minute.
Yes.
Two things here. Alexander Downer is quite conservative. And emotionally, politically, sympathetically, he may well have been looking forward to a Trump victory in that election campaign. That's one thing. The second thing is, does Alexander Downer give off that James Bond spy, I'm recording you on my mobile phone? And why would he be recording on his phone when the guy could see the mobile phone?
Yep.
It's hardly surreptitious. Did this kind of ring an alarm bell with you?
Absolutely. I found out about this story on New Year's Day 2018, I was filling in for Fran Kelly on RN Breakfast, and there was this story that came up that the American, you know, the Trump administration and this guy, George Papadopoulos, was accusing Alexander Downer, our guy, Alexander Downer, you know, the guy that we all know of and we know all these things about, this famous Australian politician, of being basically James Bond. And it just sounded so ridiculous. And I spoke to the New York Times reporter about it, and he was like, well, yes, it's possible that we're following all the leads and we're going to find out if he was maybe a spy. And it's like, trust me, man, he's not a spy.
So when you got on the blower to Alexander Downer, was he angry or laughing at all this?
He was baffled by the whole thing. He was baffled by it. He couldn't believe that all of this trouble had come out of this thing. And he couldn't believe that he was being accused of being sympathetic to Hillary Clinton and being a key player in some sort of a
ISIS, CIA, FBI, Democrats conspiracy?
Global Ukraine involved as well conspiracy. He just couldn't believe it.
Meanwhile, the NYT, the New York Times, is taking these both sides' versions of events, despite Papadopoulos' version being somewhat implausible, very seriously. They're trying to be even-handed in this matter. What did Alexander Downer make of the New York Times report that the meeting between these two men was, quote, alcohol-soaked?
Yes, yes, yes. The New York Times said the top line of the story was that the whole investigation into Russian connections with the Trump campaign started because of an alcohol-fueled meeting at a London wine bar. And Downer's response to that is, we had one G&T. It was not alcohol-fueled. It was a short meeting. We went separate ways.
But I'm sure you've been to the United States.
Yes.
They think if an Australian is present, everyone must have been hammered. I do think that's probably an American prejudice in the American mind. That could explain that remark. They just took that as given.
Absolutely. But it's crucial to remember that not only is Alexander Downer not James Bond, he's also not Crocodile Dundee. I mean, I don't know Alexander Downer personally. I've only had this one long conversation with him about this meeting, but he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy to sink 50 tinnies on the weekend and run his mouth about, you know, international secrets to people he meets in London wine rooms.
So what lessons do you think can be drawn from this debacle, Matt?
Well, I mean, it's that there's no way to prove whose story is right and whose story is wrong. There's no way for us to say, I am certain that Alexander Downer is telling the truth.
I'm pretty 99% certain that Downer's telling the truth here, I would say.
But that's the thing. We can't prove it, is what I'm saying. We can't say, none of us were there, there is no actual recording of the conversation. And so we just have to...
Well, that's just what they want you to think.
Yeah, that's right. Downer actually said in the meeting, oh, look, I was touching my phone a lot, but I was checking my emails because I was so bored by the conversation, which he said was a bit rude, but I wasn't recording him. A rude habit, he said. So, but the thing is that we as readers, as writers, as in all of those things, sometimes you just have to go, this guy said that, that guy said that. I really don't think that guy's story is possible, and this guy's story makes perfect sense to me. So I'm just going to treat that one as the likely true story. But there is uncertainty about all these things, and sometimes you just have to pick which side you think is most feasible.
Again, yes, all history is unstable in this case, and even journalism particularly in this case. But I think another lesson maybe of this is that amidst all the feverish coverage of American politics in the United States, even in the grey lady, the New York Times, perhaps the local perspective in Australia from Australia might be a little more helpful.
Yes. Maybe just a short conversation with Alexander Downer and you'll understand that he's not James Bond.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Now, another theory you have, which I think is 100% true, is this attraction we have, and they are very attractive, these stories, this idea of this hinge moment, the butterfly effect, this one little thing happened one day, consequently, the whole of world history changed. And the example you begin with this is the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the role played by a German teenager named Matthias Rust. Can you just explain what happened with this young man and his insane caper that he pulled off way back in 1987?
Yes. So Matthias Rust was a teenager in 1987, and he was getting his pilot's license. He was getting his numbers up on a Cessna. He was flying a Cessna around Western Europe and up into Scandinavia and that kind of thing. And he decided one day that when he was flying from Finland back towards Germany, he made a left turn over the Baltic Sea, and he made his way over 700 miles of Russian countryside through the Iron Curtain all the way to Moscow, at which point he landed on Red Square.
How was he able to land a plane in Red Square without being shot out of the sky by a Soviet jet fighter?
Well, I mean, that's the question that the Soviets spent years trying to figure out afterwards. Basically, what happened was he threaded through a number of pieces of Swiss cheese. He was too small to be picked up on certain radars. He was too low. But the thing was that he was picked up as he travelled over the countryside, not all that fast. He was going about as fast as a BMW on the Autobahn, to give a German example. They dispatched a fighter jet to go and figure out who he was and what he was doing there. But he's sort of pootling along at Cessna speed, and they've sent a supersonic MiG to go and check him out. So the MiG is apparently trying to fly next to him without falling out of the sky. You know, I can imagine inside the MiG's cockpit, every alarm is going off. Too slow! Stall!
And Matthias Rust is going, puckada, puckada, puckada.
Exactly. Exactly. They just didn't think that he was a big enough threat to have to shoot out of the sky. And he just slipped through gaps, basically.
So he lands in the car park.
Well, in fact, the last gap he slipped through, the most extraordinary gap of all, perhaps, is he landed on the bridge that leads into Red Square. And the thing is, that bridge has got trolley buses running over it, which means it's got a catenary over the top of it of trolley bus wires.
Like tram wires.
Like tram wires, yes, right. Exactly.
God, that would have killed him instantly if he'd hit those wires.
Absolutely. The thing was, the catenary of wires had been removed the previous day for maintenance and was put up the day afterwards. So the last line of defence, these wires, also just happened to not be there that day and when he landed in Red Square and, as you say, parked in the car park.
Now, everyone was talking about it the next day and of course, this was much admired in Australia because he looked like the closest thing to a German larrikin that we'd ever seen in
Absolutely.
Our lives, this guy. What happened when he got out of the plane? What did he do?
Well, people ran up to him and started chatting to him. And when he was asked, why are you here? He said, oh, I just came to make friends. Signed autographs until he was taken away eventually by the KGB.
So he was put in prison for 14 months in a Soviet jail and was a hero when he got back to Germany as this great peace activist who'd done this insane thing but had sort of come off and made the Soviet Union a little bit of a laughing stock. But what was Matthias Rust like really, Matt?
Well, Matthias Rust returned and was sort of this bit of a folk hero. He bopped from job to job and eventually got a job in a hospital. And he went one day to ask one of the nurses out on a date. And the nurse said no, and she made a joke about his flight being a big publicity stunt and that she wasn't impressed by this thing that he had done. And he pulled out a switchblade and stabbed her three times. She survived, thankfully. He was subsequently put on trial, and it became clear that he was a deeply strange person in many different ways. And in fact, one of the judges in his trial wrote in the judgment, "The accused is indeed a weird man." He was clearly not the folk hero that so many people wanted him to be. And afterwards, people were spitting at him in the streets. He was really kind of an outcast for many years after that.
But what was the fallout for the top brass in the Soviet Union? What did Mikhail Gorbachev make of this young man being able to fly through all these holes in the Swiss cheese of their defences?
Well, it was deeply, deeply embarrassing for the Soviet Union for a number of reasons, one of which was that the people in the Soviet Union, their understanding was that we live like this. We do not have the luxuries and extravagance of the West. And one of the reasons for that is we need to build a massive, enormous, powerful, impregnable military that can protect us from the evil capitalists. And then a teenager in a rented Cessna just flew through all of those defences. And they were furious about this, understandably, because they were like, why do I have to live like this if you can't even keep a Cessna out of this country? So it was deeply embarrassing for the Soviet government, and Mikhail Gorbachev, the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, was furious about it and conducted a purge of many top levels of air defence and the military. And that purge made a lot of people really angry in the military. It destabilised the country, and an argument could be made that that destabilisation, the fact that they weren't seen as being as all-powerful as the Soviet people had been led to believe, led in many ways to the dissolution of the Soviet Union just 4 years after Matthias Rust's flight.
This is the coup of 1991, where Mikhail Gorbachev was arrested while he was on holiday, once again in Crimea, I think it was, wasn't
it? Yes, it was, yes.
Once again. And that in turn led to a counter-coup by Boris Yeltsin, and then that's the end of the Soviet Union. So the argument might be made, maybe not very successfully, but the argument might be made was, teenager flies plane, lands in Red Square, humiliates the top brass gets sacked angrily by the leader of the Soviet Union, creates all these pockets of rebellion and resentment within the Red Army that then topples him and then are counter-toppled again in 1991. That's how the Soviet Union came to an end at the hands of a 19-year-old.
It's a beautiful, tidy story.
It's a very tidy story. But then there's the Chernobyl story.
Yes, absolutely. 1 year, 1 month and 2 days before Matthias Rust's flight was the date that the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl exploded. And you could make many of the same arguments about that leading to the collapse of the Soviet Union. In fact, Gorbachev himself wrote later in life that the explosion was perhaps the cause of the Soviet Union's collapse 5 years later. So one could make the same argument about the embarrassment of that and the betrayal that Soviet citizens felt about being left unsafe in the wake of that explosion.
So that's the second argument, but I don't think either of those arguments are very good.
No, neither do I.
The economy was in the hole for the longest time. It was an authoritarian, cruel regime that had held on through terror. And when Gorbachev, who was clearly quite a decent man, let go of the terror, there was really no legitimacy or any way for the regime to hang on. These great historical events don't happen because of a butterfly effect. They happen because of a whole lot of approximate and general causes, don't they? I mean, isn't that the lesson you take from this?
Absolutely. There were a million different causes of that. The reason I got into this is I love movies and stories about time travel. You know, someone is sent back in time to prevent the Kennedy assassination.
Sliding doors moments.
If I just go back and I change one thing, if I unflap that wing of a butterfly, then the world will all be fine now. And I just don't think that I think that those moments don't really exist.
We've been talking about hinge moments, butterfly effect moments in world history. I think it's time we need to focus a bit more onto the history of Matt Bevin. Your book is dedicated to your wife, Rachel. What was the hinge moment of your meeting, and was it a hinge moment?
Well, I see this really as a perfect example of the fact that there aren't hinge moments. There aren't moments. We met in a drama class when I was 13 and she was 15, and we paid absolutely no attention to each other at all. We were in this drama class together and we didn't talk to each other. A year and a half after that, both of us were cast in an amateur dramatic production at Newcastle's Young People's Theatre, a version of Seven Little Australians.
Seven Little Australians. How lovely. That's very wholesome.
Yes, it's an odd sort of Australian version of The Sound of Music with a sad ending. But the odd thing about this is I was cast as one of the children, one of the Seven Little Australians. My now wife, Rachel, was cast as my stepmother.
That's what... Really?
Yes. She was your stepmother.
Right.
The new second wife of the captain, who was the father of all these little kids.
Okay, this is complex.
But the captain was played by my real-life father. So my now wife was on stage married to my real father for half a year, really, as they rehearsed together, sang love songs to each other and all that sort of thing. And sort of we sort of became friends at the time, but we still didn't get together for another 2 years. And identifying a moment in amongst that years and years long process of us eventually deciding that we would become a couple is impossible. And it was a deeply odd situation. But the thing was, our lives were all so deeply intertwined by this time we eventually got together. It almost felt like a long term inevitability.
But could it be argued that that moratorium between the end of that very strange production of Seven Little Australians and you getting together, that's the hinge 2 year moratorium?
It's difficult. But I think we would all love to think that there is a moment where I saw her across the room and we fell in love at that moment. And I just think that in so many cases, it's like the collapse of the Soviet Union. So many different things were all happening at once that just led to what is now a wonderful long-term relationship that I've been in with Rachel for many years.
Okay, let's move on to the next Bevin thesis of history.
Yes.
And this is concerning supervillains, people who are villainous on quite a very, very large scale. The instinct we have, by and large, is to attribute all kinds of satanic malevolent powers of genius to them, evil genius. And this comes out of the Bond movies. Once again, you have Blofeld in a satellite patting a bald cat. Genius. What do you think the truth is about some of the world's great villains?
We love to portray Vladimir Putin as being in a mountain lair with a hairless cat like Blofeld, or Kim Jong-un in a similar way. People will often go, I don't like him because he's a villain, and he's a villain because he wants to be evil. And I've been looking at men who do bad things for a very long time now, and in most cases, there's some rationality around what they're doing. In their circumstance of life, this is what makes the most sense for them. Particularly, I think about this a lot, particularly in the case of Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un, son of...
Kim Jong-il, son of Kim Il-sung.
Yes, the inheritor of a family dynasty in which the family have done so many terrible, terrible, nightmarish things to their people in order to stay in power. And Kim Jong-un, what's he supposed to do? Try and unwind that without being killed and punished for the sins of his entire family.
So you're saying him becoming the dictator of North Korea is him really following the path of least resistance?
Yes, I think so. He had a brother, Kim Jong-nam, who potentially could have been a rival for the leadership of that country, who didn't become the leader, and Kim Jong-un killed him in order to make sure there was no separate power base, because that would have seemed to him at the time to be the most logical choice. I don't think that many of these guys are sitting there going, how can I be evil today? What can I do today that will be the most evil and nasty thing that I can do? I think in so many cases they do what seems logical to them.
The Australian historian Paul Hamm has written a wonderful book called Young Hitler, The Early Years of Adolf Hitler. And one of the first things he said when I interviewed him about it was one of the important things to understand about Adolf Hitler was when he was at school, he failed German.
Mm.
Hitler failed German. I read an enormous amount about Hitler. And I began this dawning realization about him is that he wasn't a genius.
No.
He was a compelling but deeply mediocre and quite lazy man. And I think maybe one of the horrors of him is that such a creature became so powerful and was able to get where he got to be without being stopped.
And Vladimir Putin is the perfect example of that. Vladimir Putin isn't a super genius. He's the guy who just happened to be in the right place at the right time and know the right people at the right moment and have the right desires to try and take control of a country that was ripe for someone to step in.
This is M. Gessen's theory of Vladimir Putin, who's met Vladimir Putin
yes.
in Russia. M. Gessen believes that Vladimir Putin is a pretty much run-of-the-mill KGB thug who was in the right place at the right time. And if he wasn't running Russia, there'd probably be someone quite like him from some other part of the KGB.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think he proves that over and over again by making utterly bizarre decisions that don't make any sense. Invading Ukraine. If you read his justification for invading Ukraine, it's just nuts. It just doesn't make any sense. It's some sort of story and conspiracy theory that he's partially read and partially written himself. And it's just this, a story that doesn't make any logical sense, but it's the thing he believes. And so he goes out and acts upon it in a way that has cost him and his people so, so very much.
Let's go down a couple of pegs down from Vladimir Putin to the late Yevgeny Prigozhin, who was his former mercenary warlord. Now, he popped up in the news after the invasion of Ukraine. We often saw him in combat fatigues, looking like a total warlord hard case. What was his background, though? How did he get into Putin's orbit?
Yeah, I kind of see Prigozhin as one of the exceptions to my claim, because I think Prigozhin was to a certain extent in it for the love of the game. He was an aspiring winter sports athlete as a child. He became a street thug. He went to jail. He spent most of the 1980s in prison. He emerged from prison and started a hot dog stand with his mother and stepfather, and then he leveraged that to get into supermarkets, then he leveraged that to get into restaurants, and eventually he found himself right place, right time, serving dinner to the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, who was Vladimir Putin, who ended up becoming a few years later the president of Russia, and found himself in Vladimir Putin's orbit and leveraged that to gain more power and more influence.
What was their relationship like? Was it one of equals or one
no.
of... No.
No, I don't think so. I think all the experts who've written about Putin and written about Prigozhin say that they were allies. But Prigozhin spent the 80s, as I say, in prison, and Putin spent it in the KGB. And that's a very, very important distinction in Russia.
It's a bit like Nettie Smith and Roger Rogerson. Roger Rogerson always thought he was a cut above Nettie Smith, didn't
that's
he?
That's right,
yeah,
yes, yes.
Nettie Smith was a crook and he was a cop, and
that's
that made
right.
all the difference.
It did, and one of the interesting things about Prigozhin is because he was a thug and because Putin saw him like that, Putin didn't see him as a threat. Until he became one.
So how did Prigozhin make the leap from being a celebrity chef, effectively,
yes.
in St. Petersburg, to leading a private mercenary army?
So he started a catering business. Putin gave him extraordinary catering contracts, catering to Russian schools and to the Russian military. This made him a billionaire. He started leveraging his money to get into various other jobs, other ways that he could help Vladimir Putin in some way. And one of those was to set up this mercenary group called the Wagner Group, which did all sorts of terrible things in all sorts of parts of the world. In Africa, they did some really terrible things. And when Putin found himself in trouble in Ukraine, he called in Prigozhin, and Prigozhin started recruiting prisoners primarily to come into his mercenary army, who he would then send to the front line.
These are guys who are used to shooting unarmed civilians, like a lot of mercenary armies. What happened when they were deployed in Ukraine and were up against highly motivated, trained Ukrainian soldiers?
Well, they died in enormous numbers.
They were shot to pieces,
they were shot to pieces, absolutely. And many of them were being sent there with very little training because they were hired out of prison.
So what about his downfall then?
Well, he became a social media celebrity in Russia. He became incredibly popular. And he started criticising not Putin directly, but certainly Putin's government, and saying that his men were being mistreated, that his men were not being resourced properly by the Russian military. And this made him angrier and angrier. The social media algorithm reinforced his anger and made him more and more popular and more powerful. And then one day he decided to launch a coup attempt against the Kremlin. He turned his mercenaries away from the front line. They took control of the city of Rostov-on-Don. And then they all jumped in a convoy and started driving towards Moscow, apparently with the goal of kidnapping the defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, and taking him hostage.
And that didn't happen, did it?
No, Putin ordered airstrikes on the convoy as they were driving on the freeway through Russia, and apparently, according to various reports, made threats against Prigozhin's family, and Prigozhin backed down, disbanded his group, and then was mysteriously on a plane that happened to explode a few months later. And that was the end of him.
That was the end of Prigozhin. So what do you make of this man, this street crim turned prisoner turned celebrity chef turned internet troll turned mercenary group leader? What do you make of this guy?
Well, I think this is the interesting thing about him, and I've collected a few stories of people that I think are the unusual exception, that they are real villains. These are guys who clearly have skills. They've clearly got the ability to lead, to do something that is valuable. He had clearly had business acumen. He clearly had skills. And he decided, you know what I'm going to use this for? I'm going to be the head of a mercenary army. I'm going to kill people in Syria and in Africa. I'm going to find a whole bunch of ways to do terrible things and gain power that way, which I think is unusual and different to Vladimir Putin.
I interviewed recently a psychologist from Canada, Leanne Tenbrink, who's talking about the psychopathic personality. Mm. And the common thing is an appetite for risk.
Yes.
Is this what's common amongst these villains, that this is the thing, not their intelligence, that makes them extraordinary? Is their appetite for risk-taking? Perhaps 99 times out of 100, they all flame out, but that one other guy or woman who succeeds really succeeds.
And it's the person who slides through the Swiss cheese like Matthias Rust. It's the person who doesn't run into the barriers that other people do. And I think Yevgeny Prigozhin and some of the other people that I've pulled together in this chapter about villains really, really fill that description. They're really interesting people who make a bunch of very morally problematic decisions when they really, I think, could have made ethical decisions, but they decided not to for the love of the game, I think.
Just finally, Matt.
Yes.
There's another kind of historical story you like, which is people being in the right place at the right time. And one of your favourite stories for this involves the great Aretha Franklin. Please do tell me the story about the Aretha Franklin miracle at the 1998 Grammy Awards.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of the moment that just happened because of coincidence. It didn't change the world, but it was just an incredible moment. So this is 1998. Luciano Pavarotti was at the height of his powers, and Pavarotti had been hired to come and sing at the Grammys that year. Before the Grammys, there was a big charity event honouring Pavarotti, and various artists were asked to come along and sing famous Pavarotti songs, their own songs, in a big concert. It was a couple of nights before the Grammys. And one of the people that sang there was Aretha Franklin. And as a bit of a treat for the audience that day, she sang Nessun Dorma, which was Pavarotti's big number. And then a couple of nights later, the Grammys began, the performance of the Grammys. And of course, this is 1998, and so 25 million people or something are watching the Grammys. After the beginning of the event, the producer of the Grammys, Ken Ehrlich, gets a phone call from Pavarotti. Pavarotti says, "I cannot sing for you tonight. My voice is bad. I will sing for you next year." Now, Pavarotti's song, his performance of Nessun Dorma, was kind of meant to be the climactic piece of the Grammys. And now there was a big hole in the program.
Big Pav is out.
Yeah. Ken Ehrlich, who produced the Grammys for 39 years, had just read somewhere that, did I see that Aretha sang Nessun Dorma the other night? She's booked to sing Respect tonight. Maybe I could get her to sing Nessun Dorma instead.
Now, is the show already going to air live at this point?
The show is underway.
It's underway. Okay, so what does Ken Ehrlich do once he's had this idea?
So Ken runs to Aretha's dressing room. She's having some chicken, and he says, "Pavarotti's out. Can you sing Nessun Dorma?" She says, yes, Ken, I can do that.
She does.
Of course. Of course she does.
It's Aretha. Aretha Franklin, right.
And the thing was, there was no ability to rehearse.
Oh, of course. Right. She's got this, what, a giant orchestra there?
A full orchestra is there to play with Pavarotti. Pavarotti obviously is singing it in a different key to what she is used to singing it.
But she's Aretha Franklin.
But she's Aretha Franklin. She was willing to give it a go. The conductor of the orchestra came up. They just sort of listened to the Pavarotti on cassette, his rehearsal tape. She did a couple of run-throughs just singing with the conductor.
The cassette?
With the cassette and with the conductor, right, in her dressing room. And then Sting introduces, unexpectedly, singing Nessun Dorma, Aretha Franklin. She comes out and she blows the roof off the Radio City Music Hall. And she gives a performance that is unlike any other because of the circumstances around it. Because this was last-minute, unrehearsed magic that only Aretha could do. She wasn't imitating Pavarotti like I was a moment ago. She was doing it herself. She was doing the New Orleans soul version of Pavarotti's signature tune. She made it her own. She did something that nobody else could do in a moment, and it was absolute magic.
Let's go out on that now. This is Aretha Franklin singing Nessun Dorma at the 1998 Grammys. Matt, it's been such a pleasure having this chat with you. Thank you so much, Matt.
You're welcome, Richard.
Matt Bevan's book is called If You're Listening, Declassified.
Oh, Prince, then shed my kisses, break the silence, let me be mine.
Aretha Franklin singing Nessun Dorma at the 1998 Grammys. Today's conversation with Matt Bevan was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Alice Moldovan. Executive producer was Eliza Kirsch. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.